Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
I wish I was a million miles from here tonight, satellite. I wish I, man, I wish I might, satellite. Wish I was a million miles from here tonight, satellite.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Justin McGoldrick? Y'all like Justin? Originally from rural Bendigo, Victoria, Australia, and simultaneously influenced by his parents' love of Aussie icon Slim Dusty and American great Johnny Cash, Justin McGoldrick now makes Little Rock his home. He has CDs for sale after the show, and more can be found at justinmcgoldrick.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark was a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist here on our set. Tonight our featured artist is Little Rock mosaic artist Stephanie Darnell with all of these pieces. And the featured piece is this beautifully mosaic guitar down here, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Stephanie at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight, our writers all grapple with being lost and found, whether it's concepts, themselves, or someone they love. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Wetzel Legrone finds himself lost not once, but twice. And we'll end the night with Mae Griebel as she gets close to losing it while searching for someone she loves. But let's start the night with Mary Lester, the Southern Heat, and words that help her find her way back to herself in Losing and Finding Beauty in 110 Degrees.
I search for my blue-robed nephews across a sea of fanning programs at the graduation. It is 98 degrees outside and at least that inside the Catholic High School for Boys gymnasium with no air conditioning. As my legs glue to the wooden bleachers permanently before long, I notice the husband and wife sitting in the row in front of me are actually sitting on towels. Mental note for younger nephew's graduation. Bring a towel. As I count fans, my mind is taking trips. The single one who did not have children, I'm surrounded by family and families. And it's times like these when my insecurities quickly move to the top of the charts. Am I good enough? Beautiful enough? Will I ever fall in love again? My sweet Mama Dale often reminds her now single daughter, you can fall in love at any age. To fall in love, I believe one must be able to love and feel worthy of receiving love. Maybe to be beautiful, I have to feel worthy of having beauty and be able to give it away. But right now, I don't feel like giving anything away, even my sticky seat. And to top it off, when we leave here, it's a pool party. I will have to make a decision. Capri pants and dipping toes in the shallow end? Or is it swimsuit time. I see Audrey, my 8-year-old great-niece, at the end of one of our rows, even though her father tragically died when she was 5. Audrey is a joy to all our lives. We love her a little more. Her easy smile is still a mystery to me. She is sitting on my sister's lap, and even in the heat, I'm hoping she's heading for mine. 3 hours later, I am actually in a swimming pool in a suit. The cool water is tempering my hot memories. I had survived the graduation, and hopefully, I would survive wearing a swimsuit. I had not dared to even wear a swimsuit in maybe 1,000 years, give or take a few. For this baptism by pool, I had chosen the one-piece black and white polka-dotted bow in front suit. Surprisingly, it passed the full mirror test. Only a slight wince, not a huge one with an added heavy sigh. Like so many women, I have quite the collection of swimwear. A one-piece, a two-piece. I would have a three-piece if I thought it would help. Really, the three-piece is the T-shirt over the two-piece. My family would make me move to Mars if I wore that three-piece option in public. I have prints, solids, no straps, one strap tied around my neck. Such a menagerie has taken up residence in my closet. Age has given me more wisdom and sparkle, and more wrinkles and body issues. I can gain a pound by simply breathing heavily next to food. Gravity is a force to be reckoned with, an evil foe. And I haven't been winning the Take No Prisoners waistline war. I miss my old body. Where did it go, and how can I get it back? Still waging war with my foreign body, I see my lawyer sister at the edge of the pool. Her swimsuit top is even longer than mine. Once you are a woman of a certain age, you wear swimsuit tops that really are stretchy polyester skirts. And to quote my sister, black is the color of choice. What are you doing this summer? My sister questions as we pass the time in the pool. You know, I think I have one more beautiful in me, and I'm going to find it this summer. My hands move the cool water as I emphasize my quest and wonder how my words will be received. She looks up, pauses, and then reflects seriously. I think you have more than one, two at least. She's the realistic sister, I'm the romantic. The realistic lawyer sister who has no Kleenex box in her office talks in facts, not hyperbole as I do. The sun sprinkles light on the water, magnifying her unexpected stamp of approval. Did I just lose 10 pounds? I sure like this hope diet. Great fuel for my beautiful quest. Having overheard the conversation, precious Audrey turns around and swims toward me. Audrey, who is blonde and blue-eyed and as pure-hearted as an angel from heaven. Sometimes I think Audrey really isn't of this world. Her instincts beyond her years have stopped me in my tracks more than once. Aunt Mary, people tell me I'm beautiful, and I don't believe them sometimes. Her words break my heart on so many levels. Having had such a loss as her father, I do not want her questioning any other deep issues in life. I want to protect her from what looks like the same pain that had stung me my whole life and is coming back for round two. Subtract more than a few decades, and I am there with my mother having the same conversation. Just look in the mirror, you'll see a pretty face. Looking in the mirror didn't help then. It certainly doesn't help now. Nothing really helped until I became an actress and heard several trusted directors say, "You have a face the camera loves." And it has been way too long since I've heard those words, but my Cherokee cheekbones the camera loves haven't sailed for Argentina yet. The conversation happens in a millisecond, undergirding my silent prayer as I find Audrey's eyes. Let her heart hear and her eyes see. You're beautiful, Audrey. I wouldn't say that if it weren't true. If only she would believe me. If only she wouldn't have to look in a mirror or a magazine, or worse yet, wait to believe those words from a stranger. Audrey holds my gaze, and I feel like all 8 years of her are looking inside me, looking through me. "You're beautiful, Aunt Mary," she says as the reflection of the blue water glistens in her eyes. "I wouldn't tell you if it weren't true." As quickly as the sun dances on a dragonfly's wing, true beauty takes root and blossoms in both of us.
Mary Elaine Lester, a career mathematics instructor, currently reaches rural Arkansas via distance learning. A professional actress experienced in theater, film, and commercials, Mary is hoping for beautiful moments in all of us. Next, Wetzel Lagrone gets turned around the first time, but is then better prepared for the second time in Lost.
It was in the spring of 1961. If being young and dumb were illegal, we would have been arrested. We did not have any life preservers. The wind was calm, so we crossed a lot of open water that we shouldn't have crossed in a little boat, and I paid no attention to where we were going. That morning, my new neighbor, Johnny Hamilton, had asked me to go to Lake Nimrod with him in his little 12-foot plywood boat with a 3.5-horsepower motor on it to fish. Well, I hadn't lived in Arkansas long enough to know where to go, and I liked fish, and I was delighted with the invitation. A Lake Nimrod is a U.S. Corps of Engineers lake on the Fish LaFlave River in Yell County, Arkansas. We launched the boat at Sunset Bay Ramp on the upper end of the lake near Plainview. Since Johnny had told me that he fished quite often, I assumed that he knew what he was doing. I should have paid attention. It was a nice day. We caught some fish. Then it started getting late, and we decided we needed to go home. As we motored across the water, Johnny mentioned that there was a lot of spring rain, and the Corps of Engineers had not opened the spillways to let draw down the lake, so a lot of water was considerably higher than usual. The first time I realized we were in trouble is when we ran into a barbed wire fence. We cruised around a little, and the sun was going down. After wandering around another half hour or so, Johnny said, "This high water has changed. I'm lost." Well, I didn't have a clue. By this time, it was dark. Luckily, it was a clear night with a little moonlight. Johnny said, "There's a waterfall coming off the mountain directly across from Sunset Bay. When we find it, we can come straight back across to the ramp." Problem was, we were on the north side of the lake, and the mountain was on the south side. And by this time, I was wondering if we had enough gasoline in the tank on top of that little motor to get us across the lake. Having no other plan, we set out across the open water, and I fully expected to run out of gas just any second. We made it across the lake and slowly cruised along the shore next to the mountain. I just knew we were going to run out of gas. After what seemed forever, I finally spotted a little waterfall coming off the highest side of the hill. Johnny made a 90-degree turn, and we slowly eased across the lake. Then the most beautiful sight, the boat ramp. 11 years later, I was working for Rockwell Manufacturing in their Texarkana plant. One of our major suppliers was Texas Foundries Company in Lufkin, Texas. Texas Foundries leased 3,000 acres near where Loco Bio ran into the Antelina River. They had a lodge there and invited some customers for a squirrel hunt. Since I paid the bills for our plant, I was fortunate enough to be asked to participate. Hunters went out on Friday afternoon, Saturday morning, afternoon, and Sunday. Hunters had different sections every day. The second morning, I drove by myself down an old road on the edge of the property to hunt near Loco Bio. The weather was overcast, so I checked my compass to be sure of the direction I was entering the woods. The terrain was completely flat, but I felt fine by myself in unfamiliar woods. After about an hour and a half, I had killed 9 squirrels and hunted another one that would be my limit. I located the tree the squirrel was in, but had to circle it a couple of times before I spotted him and shot him. Then I started back out of the woods to my truck. Uh-oh, that's when my heart started thumping and I wasn't sure I knew which direction to go. The fishing trip more than a decade earlier came rushing back to me, and I thought to myself that I was no longer young, and I hope I was no longer dumb. I took out my compass, but then wasn't sure I believed it. I thought I remembered the truck was one direction. The compass said it was another direction. Maybe the metal in the gun was causing it to be wrong. I moved away from the gun. I shook the compass, and it still pointed in the same direction. So I decided to give it a chance and follow it for a few minutes. Evidently, I had wandered around a bit while hunting, for in a few minutes, I walked out on the road about 30 steps from my truck. As I put my gun to squirrels in the truck, I was relieved that I had the years and wherewithal to not only believe my compass, but to have it with me in the first place. While it had been scary, being lost on the lake in 1961 made me more aware of safety precautions. And in 1972, I was more than thankful for that doggone compass, and it had been right after all.
Since he retired in 2003, Wetzel Legrone has given over 7 gallons of blood to the Red Cross and urges everyone to contact their local unit and give. Wetzel keeps busy in retirement by doing volunteer work in Arkansas. In our final story of the night, Mae Griebel thinks she has lost a loved one, and then the panic sets in Nemo Lost Again.
No, Nemo. No, Nemo, no. I shouted at the TV screen. My 23-year-old daughter and I curled up on the couch in our hotel room, armed with an enormous bag of popcorn and a pound of dark chocolate truffles, watching the movie Finding Nemo. As Nemo swam away exploring his surroundings, I began to cry and cry and cry. Mama, Lauren said, you are screaming and sobbing so loudly, you'll wake up the people next door. For heaven's sakes, calm down. Just a year earlier, our daughter had studied in Fiji. Despite the lengthy trip, we flew out to join her. The first day, she took us shopping in the market and haggled for prices with us. Then she missed the group bus ride back to her youth hostel. I wasn't sure how she'd get there, a distance of about 30 kilometers. It was late afternoon when she left us at the hotel on Denali Island. We were fairly certain that our streetwise daughter would be fine, but early in the evening, the phone woke us up. Lauren's local program director asked if she had gone back without the others. Honey, I said to my spouse as I hung up the phone, that was Lauren's director. She hasn't made it there. Fear and anxiety mingled with the sweat on my brow. Our faces were question marks as we stared at each other. What should we do? We were clueless in a strange place. We didn't know how to reach the youth hostel. We weren't even sure of its name. Because I was so upset, I had failed to get the director's contact information. So we tried to reach our daughter via Skype. After we had asked for her, a deep, heavily accented male voice said, just a minute, please. We heard something that sounded like CNN in the background and then a dog's barking louder and louder. No one else came to the phone, despite our screaming and begging. We called 3 times, and the same scenario happened each time. We had called her number, yet an unknown male had answered. It all seemed ominous. Our panic levels rose vertically. We usually are take charge people, but we were weary and in a land unknown to us. Politically, Fiji was tense. At that point, a year to the day, after the last coup d'etat, should we try to rent a car? But it was after hours and we had no idea where to go. Should we just ignore it and go back to sleep? not likely with me. This was not the first time that Lauren had disappeared. When she was 4 years old, we were on our last shopping trip with our neighbors from North Carolina before returning to Arkansas. Lauren wanted to leave our dressing room to go to the neighbor's room where her girlfriend was trying on new clothes for school. Since they were close by in the same store, I gave her permission. After sorting our purchases, I left our room. My friend and her daughter were standing by the desk. No Lauren. They hadn't seen her. The shop personnel didn't remember a little blonde-haired girl. Hoping that she was playing the find me hidden among the racks of clothing game, I searched the store. Still no daughter. I looked out the door and then finally ventured down the long central corridor of the mall. My daughter, she's gone, I screamed. Simultaneously, the shop personnel had the doors of the mall locked by the security police. But this took several minutes to accomplish. That could be time enough for someone to take her into the ladies' room, cut her hair, drug her, disguise her, and then leave the mall. In my mind, I quit my upcoming job, took up permanent residence in North Carolina, inevitably got divorced, and devoted my entire life to the no doubt fruitless search for my little girl for all eternity. No melodrama in my imagination. After 10 minutes of my escalating alarm, my 4-year-old came strutting toward me down the main hallway saying, Mommy, Mommy, I hunted everywhere, but I can't find Elizabeth or Mama. I looked and looked. I was so relieved to see her, I couldn't even fuss at her for leaving the store. I just hugged her and hugged her. That evening in Fiji, there suddenly was a time warp. She was 4 years old and I had lost her. It was my fault. I knew that she'd been sold into the slave market. She's really cute, I thought. I know that she'll bring great sums of money on the slave market. Was there even such a thing? Maybe not, but I knew for sure that it existed. I recently retired after more than 23 years at Arkansas Children's Hospital. In May, I will have been married happily for 30 years. None of these could have happened had our daughter actually disappeared while we were shopping. We had dodged the bullet once. The situation that night in Fiji was finally resolved by our going to the front desk of the hotel. The operator graciously, at 11 o'clock at night, rang the place where our daughter had to be staying based on the limited information that we did know. She convinced the unwilling personnel to hike down to the youth hostel area of the resort to awaken our groggy daughter and then to drag her to the phone. Why in the dickens are you waking me up at such an hour? Lauren grumbled, the irritation poorly disguised in her voice. I have never been so happy to be blessed out by my daughter. For a second time, pending disaster passed us by. The feelings that one experiences from such a situation are still pretty raw. How does one ever get over the intense dread of losing one's child? Parenthood is wonderful, but is indeed a risky proposition. Nemo should never have entered the area proscribed by his father. As I watched that movie, I sobbed and yelled, Nemo, Nemo, no, Nemo, go back, Nemo, go back, go back, go back. And then I sobbed some more. Fortunately, it ended well for all of us. Thank you.
May Griebel, proud to be Lauren's mother and Jack's wife, enjoys riding as much as she does traveling. Known among her friends as being cool and collected, She is waiting for an idea for the first great novel to strike her, and in the meantime, fights daily with the ravages of Parkinson's disease. She has been retired for a year and misses her kids horribly. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argento Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argento Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Tales from the South is presented by the Argento Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing, with additional support provided by AY Magazine, William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American Magazine. Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio Productions. Our graphics are by Robin Steves at Studio B. Our musician is Mark Simpson. Our stage art is by V.L. Cox. Our production engineer is Jay Jones. And our executive producer and host is Paula Morrell. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.
Well, there was a time that I would have taken a bullet for you, but then you put me through more than any mortal man should be asked to do. Yeah, I took it to the vertical. I come down a flaming mess. The devil, he lives at Mach 1. The devil lives underneath your dress. So meet me down by the swamp tonight, where we heard the panther scream, where the ghosts of dead girls walk, where the slip you wear in my dreams. You got eyes that burn like foxfire. You come to me with mud on your knees. Yeah, meet me down by the swamp tonight, and let me do as I please. No more stories about Philistines and longhorns from a long gone distant past. Yeah, what a change.